Hey, everybody. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey, and I'm here with Molly Chanson. Molly, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you. Many of our readers or listeners may remember that you and I spoke, I guess it was back in October of 2020, and certainly a lot has happened since then in many ways. But one of the things that's happened since then is that you are a proud owner of a brand new book that just kind of hit the market that's called Fallen Star, A Return to Self Through the Eight Limbs of Yoga. And congratulations and well done on that. And welcome here. So,
thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a big couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. In a lot of ways, I'm sure. So I guess maybe having COVID, if you're writing a book, COVID kind of came at the right time and you kind of hold up in your house and do nothing but write for 2 years.
Yes. Yes, it was a lot of writing, a lot of being at home.
Yep. Well, well done. And again, congratulations. So what we're going to do today, and I don't know if our listeners remember, if they, and certainly those that did not have an opportunity to listen to our last discussion, let's give a little background of your situation. You your husband was unfaithful, your ex-husband, I should say, was unfaithful to you several years ago. And I guess from that kind of spurned you have a website and also kind of the motivation behind writing this book and getting really involved in yoga and kind of making that a center point of your life and everything. So maybe if you can kind of give us just a brief backstory, of that whole situation, that'd be wonderful. And then certainly I'll put a link to the previous audio at the end of this as well, so people can refer back to that if they like. But give us the quick Reader's Digest version of your past experience.
Sure. So I was married and I have two boys, and everything kind of felt like it was falling apart at once. The marriage was not good or healthy or fulfilling. It felt really distant. And I was also struggling with alcoholism. So I had these sort of two struggles going on at one time. And I decided to get sober, and I also started writing. And I was also committed to going to yoga every day. So I had these things, my recovery and the writing and the yoga. And meanwhile, my marriage wasn't improving or getting better. And I started to suspect that there might be another person, that maybe we had fallen so far apart that, he travels a lot for his job. And I started to think that maybe this was a possibility. And so I embarked on this search for what could I find? I was looking through things in the house or when he was traveling or trying to look for signs or somewhat becoming a little bit frantic about, like, can I uncover this proof? And in the end, I did find, I was about 4 months sober. I did find emails finally that confirmed for me that he was having an affair. And when that happened, I really wasn't ready. I mean, you think you want to know the truth, but do you really want to know the truth? And from there, I had already started writing and sort of writing a book. It wasn't the book that is out today and that you have read, because when I started writing it, I didn't know yet about the affair. So the book kind of goes through a lot of different stories from my life, childhood and getting married and motherhood, and those experiences. And then this finding out about the infidelity and what that did to my body, what that did to my sense of self. And so that whole journey, that process is in the book. And then what I did to move through it and how yoga supported me and taught me a lot through that process.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So your journey, with a few extra little things thrown in there, like alcoholism and everything, is very, very similar to what I think many betrayed spouses go through in their own journey. So it was a very, very interesting read. So great job again. So So what possessed you to write the book?
You know, I didn't know I was writing this book in particular. I started by writing my stories. I was drawn to writing and journaling as a way to process my experience and to heal. I had written before. I taught writing for a long time, but I had never really written my own story. And when I started writing my stories, I thought, maybe these stories are meaningful. Maybe stories about motherhood and getting married and being in a marriage and what that marriage looks like, the struggles, maybe these are meaningful. Maybe other people would also like to hear these stories or have similar stories. And then when I started understanding that my yoga practice was actually helping me through my struggles, through the infidelity, processing those emotions, then I started to think, this is very meaningful because this is a practice that can help someone heal. And prior to that, I had done yoga. I've done yoga basically my whole life, but it was always physical. It was more like an exercise, something healthy for my body. And when I started to understand the transformation and the healing that yoga could provide when you're going through something difficult, that's when the book really took shape at that point. And I knew that this was something that I wanted to share with other people.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. And I guess, you know, I certainly believe, and we kind of preach that the importance of self-care when somebody's trying to heal, not only from betrayal, but, you know, really any kind of healing from any hurt or pain or anything like that. So, I mean, in your opinion, why would you say that self-care is so important?
I think I wholeheartedly agree. And I think betrayal in particular really affects our sense of self and the idea, you know, what we think about ourselves, who we think we are, who we believe we are, or what we deserve. And so self-care to me is the most important thing in this moment. If you're dealing with betrayal or have discovered this or having this in your relationship, I think we tend to focus on the other person a lot. Like, mm-hmm. if they will change this or change that or do things differently, then I'll feel better. You know, we mm-hmm. try to control with like, you know, if we know where they are or change their phone number or stop contact with the other person or all these things that I personally sort of dealt with and went through. But really, we need to take the time to honor ourselves and what is coming up as a result of the betrayal. How do we feel, allowing ourselves to feel those things, being where we are, and of course, being really loving and kind to ourselves, because it is a huge wound, and it's a huge pain that causes physical pain, but also a deep emotional pain of, again, this kind of upsetting of our reality, both in our relationship and how we see ourselves.
Right, right. You know, I personally, you know, mentor a lot of betrayed spouses, and I find that they're often afraid to take that leap to really commit to a lot of self-care or to focus on self-care, you know, kind of step away from worrying about the other person and what they're doing and thinking as much and concentrating more on their own well-being and all that sort of thing. You know, they're just afraid to do that. I mean, did you kind of have that fear as well?
Absolutely. I think that we're kind of conditioned in the world to rely on external factors, people or circumstances or situations. We have this illusion that if we can control everything outside of us, that we will feel at ease or fulfilled or happy. And this kind of happens because we receive instant gratification when we do something external, like we eat something delicious or we buy something, or, you know, there is relief in those behaviors that are outside of us. And going inside where that permanent healing takes place is very scary, because for me, I just felt like, if I really look at myself, what am I going to find? What mm-hmm. if it's not pretty? What if I don't like it? What if there's things that are difficult to see about myself. And so I think in general, looking at ourselves is very scary and very difficult because it's mm-hmm. it's unknown. It's like, what will be there and what will I have to deal with? And once I started looking inside, it was like more and more came up, you know? It's almost like you clean out a basement and it gets really messy before it's finally clean again. And at one point you're kind of like, wow, I don't know if I should have gone here.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, the comment you just made about, you know, I wonder what, you know, I'm afraid to find out certain things about myself or the potential of finding things out about myself. So I see that as a reason why a lot of unfaithful people don't do self-care or don't really put in the right. work to understand why they did what they did. You know, it's not easy to really deeply investigate how you screwed up in life and, you
right.
know, brings up guilt and shame, and it's not an easy process. So I think self-care can go both ways and,
yes.
and help the unfaithful person as well. So, all right. Well, thank you. So you kind of alluded to this earlier, but explain, you know, because when Lynn and I did some yoga a few years ago, and I kind of went into it with the basic premise that it's just another form of exercise. But certainly when Lynn and I did it, we did discover it was more than that, and your book kind of reaffirms that. So maybe just if you could briefly describe how yoga is not, or it's, I should say it's more than just another form of exercise. What are some things that are associated with yoga that make it much more than that?
Sure, yes. So yoga is physical. It's also emotional and it's spiritual. So yoga affects the body and the nervous system and the brain, and definitely has a physical effect. There's a direct effect on our nervous system and our levels of stress when we're focusing on the postures and the physical practice and the breathing. But yoga is the only practice that I'm aware of that teaches us to be a witness, a non-judgmental witness. And so when we're observing the body, like when you were taking your yoga class, that time spent where the mind is focused on the sensations in the body, the mind is focused on the sensation of the breath, and this is a very powerful healing technique. So this practice of being a witness is taking us out of our stories, our narratives, our critique or criticism, our doubts, our worries, our fears, and it gives us this moment of observing the present. And when we're observing the present, that's truth, that's reality. So there's something very empowering that happens, especially when we're going through a painful moment, when we can observe our body or something happening right now, and there's a real calming, healing effect to that. The other thing that I found that was happening to me when I was practicing yoga while dealing with the betrayal is that the more I stayed present with what was happening right now, the less my mind jumped to catastrophic thinking or wild scenarios or what if situations. Which is a big thing when you're wondering what's going to happen in your marriage or what this means. And so when I was able to focus on what was happening right now, it was almost like my heart and my body, things started arriving. Emotions are, you know, once we acknowledge emotions and things we're feeling, they start to move. And in yoga, our emotions are our energy. You know, the body, again, it's a physical, anatomical piece of matter. But at the same time, we have this energy, and this is where our emotional self is. And when we go through an experience, that energy either can move or we can shut it down and it can get stuck. And so the more I practiced yoga and the more I paid attention to how my body felt and stayed, you know, tied to the present moment in that class on my mat, emotions started to bubble up, and sometimes they weren't always comfortable. But in allowing for that, they were able to move. And so things were kind of, energy was flowing, even though it was uncomfortable. it was moving, and that's how we get through something is to feel it.
Great, thanks. Well, I know everybody's different, but when one starts a practice of yoga, I assume that all these revelations that you just described don't happen from session number one. So how long does it take, would you say, on average, to kind of get to that point where you're able to experience some of what you just described?
You know, I think that it can happen pretty rapidly. So, and part of it is noticing and acknowledging the progress, even in the first class. So if you're doing a yoga practice and you experience, maybe it's a moment where you're the easiest way to notice it is maybe you're sitting or maybe you're standing. And there's a few moments that you are noticing the breath and your mind isn't off on some other narrative or story that you're telling yourself. So those tiny moments of witnessing are powerful, and it's happening right in that moment. And so, you know, maybe you're not experiencing the entire hour class of being away from your mind and out of narrative and out of stories, but you're able to glimpse little brief moments of it. And with consistency, I mean, I would say, you know, maybe 5 classes, maybe 10 classes, you'll start to notice that you are able to be a witness, that you're able to observe something in the present and not have a story running through your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I learned also from meditation. It's, you know, the key word in doing these things is that it is a practice. It's not like you sit down from day one and you can meditate on something and it necessarily works. You know, I found from the beginning I had, I guess they call it monkey brain, you know, where it's, yeah, your mind is going all over the place, a million different places, and then you have to kind of learn how to control it. So so I think it's probably, I'm sure, the same thing within the yoga practice as well.
And I think, you know, with that, a thing I always thought that I no longer know to be true is that monkey mind or the brain is always functioning that way. So the brain is going to produce thoughts because that's what the brain does. It's like expecting our heart to stop beating or something. This is how the brain works. And so every single time we notice the brain making a thought and we decide to return our attention to our breath instead of engaging with that thought, that's the practice of yoga. That's the practice of meditation, is that returning to the present moment.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Well, the subtitle of your book is A Return to Self Through the 8 Limbs of Yoga. All right. So what exactly, briefly, explain what the 8 limbs of yoga are?
Yeah.
Because I certainly didn't know any of this.
The 8 limbs of yoga, briefly. So these 8 limbs were written down probably over 5,000 years ago, and they're one of the first written sort of explanations of yoga. And so there's 8. So the yamas and niyamas are the first two, and these are ethical practices or practices and ways of life. They have to do more with who we are and how we behave and kind of our character. So some examples of the yamas and niyamas are practicing nonviolence, practicing non-stealing, practicing cleanliness and cleansing. And so it's more about our way of life than it is about a physical practice on the mat. The next two are asana and pranayama. And asana is the poses, pranayama is the breath. So these limbs of yoga that are postures and breath, these practices tend to the body. So this is exactly what we were just talking about, where it is the postures, it is the breath, but it's more about the body as an access point to our emotional self. So in witnessing the body, in witnessing the breath, mindfully moving through the physical practice, we're connecting with our body, which, you know, we don't often do. A lot of people are dissociating with our bodies all the time in society.
Right.
So those are the first four limbs. And then the last four limbs, presence, focus, meditation, and the final eighth limb, enlightenment, which we all want.
Exactly.
The last four limbs are all about the inward journey. So the last four limbs are about eliminating outside stories and distractions and moving inside. And this, for me, is where I really started to experience the healing effect of yoga, is like you and I were talking about this, this inward journey, this focus on self, this healing that, that takes place when we're looking at ourselves instead of what someone else should be doing, what we want something to happen, it's not happening, you know, turning the attention back inward, inside. And so those are the eight limbs. And I also wanted to mention, when you asked this question, that in at the end of the book, I include Dharma as part of Samadhi, this sort of elusive, like, who's enlightened? How do we get to enlightenment? How do we awaken? And to me, the easiest way, the most accessible way as a human being to sort of get close to this Samadhi is with the idea of Dharma. And Dharma is our soul's purpose. Dharma says that any experience we're having has the power to transform us or to shape us into something new. Shape us into a person of depth. And I realized that, you know, if someone would have told me when I found out that my husband was having an affair that, oh, this experience will shape you and transform you into something new. And I would have said, I don't want to hear that right now. I'm in so much pain. You know, it would have, it would have dismissed where I was in the moment. But through healing and over time, we can find meaning even in our painful experiences. And to me, this is really this final eighth limb of yoga in practice is when we can take all our experiences, good or bad or tragic, you know, heart-wrenching, whatever they are, and we can allow ourselves to feel them and to move through them, and then we arrive in a new place, you know, once we heal. That's really what healing is arriving somewhere new because we've done the work.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Thanks for explaining that. It's a wonderful description. One of the things that I learned while reading your book is the term I don't know if I'm going to say it right. Samskara?
Yes,
and, samskara. Okay. Can you explain the concept of Sanskrit and how that it can kind of parallel the thoughts or feelings that a betrayed person has after betrayal? And I think you mentioned, I put quotes on this, that it's the entry point to healing. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit and explain to our listeners what that all means?
Sure. So a samskara is a mental imprint. And mental imprints are formed in response to an experience. The bigger the experience or the more impactful, the deeper and more noticeable the samskara. So we're always having experiences. They're always shaping what we think and who we are and how we see ourselves and how we see the world. But when there's a big impactful experience, it creates a pretty deep groove, right? This mental imprint can be pretty ingrained, like a wound or, you know, samskara sounds like scar, and this is a really good way to think of it. So when we associate an experience with a belief about ourselves, we might go the rest of our lives and never really be free from that experience. So an example, when we're talking about betrayal, is that as a result of that experience, someone might be forming beliefs like, I am unlovable, or I am not enough, something's wrong with me, the other person, you know, has something I don't have, I need to be better, or it's my fault, if I would have acted differently, or if I wouldn't have done XYZ, this never would have happened. I could have prevented it. So the samskara is these beliefs that are being formed as a result of being having an unfaithful partner, and we're forming these beliefs about ourselves. And once those beliefs are formed and ingrained, like a scar or this mental imprint, it's very difficult to move on from them. It affects our beliefs, affect our behaviors, the way we move through the world, the choices we make. So that's the idea of samskara, is this this mental imprint that will affect our reality, even if that's not true. You know, those beliefs like, it's my fault, I'm unlovable, I did something wrong, those are not true.
Okay.
You asked about the entry point of healing
yeah.
in terms of samskara. So the way to heal a samskara is to become aware of it or shine a light on it. And so this is where it is painful and scary to look inside and to look at ourselves. But when we illuminate our scars and when we illuminate our beliefs about ourselves, and we start to, you know, gently get curious, like, what is this belief? Is this true? Is this belief I am carrying about myself actually true? And when we can simply ask that question, instead of choosing behaviors or things that reinforce that belief, we can start to choose different behaviors or actions. We can start to treat ourselves lovingly instead of blaming ourselves. We can start to practice self-care. You know, we can give ourselves the love and kindness that we so want from our partner in that moment. So we heal the samskara by exposing it and then kind of going a little deeper into, what is this belief and is this true?
Great. So is samskara just a general concept, or is it a part of one of these eight limbs?
Samskara isn't part of the eight limbs, but it is a concept in yoga philosophy.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, great. That's a wonderful concept. So, one of the while reading your book, I noticed that you had made a comment that I thought was kind of interesting, and it had to do with, you know, your suspicions that your husband was having an affair. And here's what you said. You said, "I want evidence that my husband does not love me because I don't know how else to trust myself." Can you kind of explain what you meant there?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you made me think on this one. So I appreciate that. and, you know, going back to the concept of samskara, our imprints, you know, are personal and they're also societal. So we are shaped by our individual experiences, and we're also shaped by cultural conditioning and society and political systems. So what I meant here and how I felt is that, you know, needing evidence of my husband's affair felt like an acceptable deal breaker for the marriage, right? Like my own unease, my own discomfort, my own unhappiness didn't feel like valid reasons to say, I want out of this marriage, or this marriage isn't good for me anymore, or whatever those feelings that were coming up, I wasn't able to trust them. I certainly wasn't able to validate them. And maybe particularly, you know, for women or for mothers, I do think that we're taught that acknowledging our feelings is selfish. That, you know, just because we feel something, just because we're unhappy, just because we're unfulfilled, it's selfish to acknowledge that and make a change and do something different. And so for me, in that moment, it was, well, if I can find proof that he's being unfaithful, then I have something that can really validate my feelings, because in our society, that's acceptable. That's an acceptable reason, you know, to leave your marriage, whereas just my own unhappiness wasn't enough.
Okay. I gotcha. That's interesting, because I know that we talk with a lot of betrayed spouses, as I mentioned, and you know they get to a point where they don't trust their own decision making. They don't trust what's real. You know, they don't trust a lot of things after this happens, just because of, you know, boom, you know, their world was imploded, and what they thought was real and what they thought was true was not actually the case. So I thought maybe that's where you were coming from, but your explanation is you know, a little bit different than what I was thinking, but I think that's great.
Sure, sure. And I also think that what you're saying is also true. You know, I think that there is this sense of questioning reality and trusting ourselves, and it's made even more it's made deeper because we're with someone that maybe is telling us that they're not being unfaithful or we're crazy or, you know, mm-hmm. what's going on. So all that's happening also, and that ability to trust ourselves is just, you know, kind of wiped out in that moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you've, you know, throughout your life, and I don't remember in the book if you said how long ago this was, but you've kind of experienced some major challenges. You know, in addition to betrayal, there was a sexual assault, you had an eating disorder, and you mentioned alcoholism and all that. So do you feel that you hit some sort of a rock bottom at any point? And if so, what did that feel like, and how would you say you got yourself out of that?
Yes, I had a few rock bottoms. And I think, you know, I think that we don't change until we are in enough pain or we're really uncomfortable. I think that's human nature. So, you know, we might know that the habit is unhealthy, the relationship is bad, the job is not what we want, but we're not willing to let something go because the familiar is comfortable and we have a fear of the unknown. And that fear is greater than whatever our discomfort is in the moment. And, you know, for me, my rock bottom was really tied to my addiction, and it was my kids. You know, seeing what I was putting my kids through with my addiction was a really powerful rock bottom that was motivating enough for me to take the scary steps to get more help and to get myself healthy. You know, another rock bottom was just trying really hard to drink normally and every time realizing that this was something that had complete control over me. And when I really understood that I had no control over this, that it was a full-blown addiction, I got really scared. Like that rock bottom was very scary, to have an awareness that this was something I couldn't control. And I started crossing so many lines that I never thought I would cross. My rational self, my real self would never have done those things. And so I knew this was something that was way out of my control. And then doing that rock bottom of, you know, I have to do something about this addiction, helped me to address all these other things. So that, you know, we want like one solution, like what's the thing that's going to make me feel better? Or we start a healing journey and we think we're healing one thing. But for me, hitting that rock bottom with alcoholism addressed the eating disorder, the assault that had never been, you know, discussed or processed or healed in any way, other unhealthy habits that I had or ways to cope with life, the unhealthiness in my marriage, like all of this kind of collapsed in the same year, and all of it sort of got exposed and opened up in one. In the book, I always call it a catastrophic moment. And you know, it wasn't one thing that got me out of it. And I wish I had the thing, like, this is going to be the thing, this is what you need to do, you know. But I think it's different for everybody. The first thing that helped me was accepting where I was, that, you know, this is my life, this is what's happening, this is where I am. And then small steps, you know, committing to that. So there's so many tools available, and I used all of them. You know, I let some go. I decided they weren't for me, but I had a therapist. I have support groups, recovery groups. I joined a writing circle. That was just so huge for me to be in a circle of writers and writing and sharing about my experience was very supportive for me. And it might, that could be different for somebody else. You know, I know people that run and join running groups. Whatever that passion is for you, that's part of your self-care. Obviously, yoga was huge for me. I mean, yoga just, that's what the book is about, is how yoga was so healing for me in terms of getting myself out of that rock bottom.
Yeah. Now, did you come to this realization, these realizations on your own, or was there somebody saying, hey, look, Molly, you need to get your shit together?
Yeah, I was pushed. So in terms of the drinking, I was pushed because I had friends and family members that were really worried about me. And that was when I started seeing a therapist. And that was the one thing I was doing in that moment. And like I said, my motivation was my kids and, you know, not wanting to cause them more pain and give them a good childhood. And then slowly in doing that, I came to understand that I was worthy of this healing. I was worthy of sobriety. I was worthy of healing from my husband's betrayal. You know, I was worthy of these things, regardless of what anybody else said or thought. And I hope, you know, I hope that people can understand their worthiness for healing before they need to get to a rock bottom, you know? Like, this is something that I wish I would have known a lot sooner, because I would have prevented a lot of pain for myself and other people.
Sure. A couple things there. One is that what you just described, you know, for your circumstances, you know, it mirrors a lot of what I hear when I'm talking to unfaithful people. You know, they're self-destructive behaviors and ultimately hitting a rock bottom. And a lot of times it's when they hit that rock bottom is, you know, when they finally decide that, you know, geez, what I'm doing isn't right. I need to stop this affair. I need to end contact. I need to go to therapy. I need to, you know, get my shit together. So, you know, it kind of goes both ways. And I think that the unfaithful people can learn from those same circumstances as well.
You know, Doug, I love that you're saying that and making that connection. And I absolutely agree. That is, I understand from my own behaviors as an alcoholic that shame and guilt and fear when you're at that rock bottom, like, what am I doing? What am I doing to myself? What am I doing to my family? Absolutely. I'm sure the unfaithful partner feels that way. And, and that, you know, that bottom, whenever you're ready to say, like, I'm worth more than this, this is enough, that starts the healing process.
Yep, absolutely. And the other thing that I took from what you described is that, you know, so often people are looking for some magic pill that they can, you know, one thing that they can do to make it all better, but it's not, it doesn't exist. It's a lot of little things that you do on a consistent basis that kind of, you know, promote the whole healing process. And, you know, yours was therapy and yoga and, you know, support group and all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, everybody needs to kind of take that approach to healing and recovery. There's not one thing you can do that's going to make everything better.
Right. It's a practice. It's like yoga. It's, I always say that consistent yoga, you know, 10 minutes a day, consistently is better than going to one class a month for an hour and a half, you know, because it's the consistency, it's the little things that add up.
Right. So taking all of that experience that you went through and what you just described, how did yoga specifically kind of help you to get out of this whole, you know, all of that rock bottom situation?
Yoga for me particularly since I've struggled with disordered eating. Yoga was the first time in this sort of situation that I acknowledged my body, or that I treated my body kindly. So even just the practice of tuning into my body and observing it as like, you know, how do my hips feel? How does my heart feel? How come when I place my hand on my heart, I feel like crying? You know, what is that? I started noticing these physical sensations and reactions in my body through the yoga, and it started to feel really kind and really good. And it was scary and foreign at first. Like this idea of loving myself, it was sort of like I always rolled my eyes. Like, I don't want to love myself. I want someone else to give me love. You know, I want love from my husband. I want love from my family and friends and kids. And I had never imagined that loving myself could feel so good. And that, you know, when we do love ourselves, we're able to love someone else. And we're also able to receive love from someone else. When we don't love ourselves, you know, those things are impossible, I think, I believe, to access. So here I am craving love, right? And then I have an unfaithful partner, which seems like the ultimate slap in the face when all I want is love. And then it sends me on this path that says, maybe you need to start loving yourself. Maybe you need to, you know, start treating your body kindly. Maybe you need to listen to your heart and trust yourself. And so that has been a really powerful experience for me. That was my experience when I started doing yoga. It just felt like the ultimate self-care.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And imagine that, you know, besides reshaping your body and things like that, you also managed to reshape who you are and your character.
Absolutely. This is the biggest gift from yoga that I did not expect or was aware of. But yoga taught me compassion, and that's for myself and that's for everyone else. And, you know, I always share this story with people and with my students, but one of my teacher trainers that I had when I became a yoga instructor, he said, if not for our individual experiences, we are all the same. And he explained that, you know, if we had the same experience as someone else, we would make the same choices they're making. And this kind of goes back to samskara, where we think we're making choices based on our rational mind. But in reality, our experiences have shaped us, and there has been an imprint that has formed a belief, and that belief is affecting our other beliefs and our actions and our choices. And it's possible that, you know, there's not as much choice as we think. I mean, of course, we have choices and the power to change, and I'm proof of that, and so many other people are as well. But that's why it's important to kind of look at our beliefs and where they're coming from, like how we were raised, what our experiences have been, you know, and kind of just, again, get curious about, like, where this is coming from for us, and is it true? You know, I grew up in a world of, like, people are separate. There's a lot of judgment in our society of this is right, this is wrong, what he's doing is wrong, what she's doing is right, you know, however we're kind of comparing to other people. And this idea of compassion that I've learned from yoga, or this idea that we are all so shaped by our experiences, teaches me that, you know, my ex-husband has his own path and his own lessons, and they have nothing to do with me. His actions, this is so important for the betrayed person to know, is that your partner's actions have nothing to do with you. That's their path. That's their experience. And so, like, now I can let that go and not internalize it or personalize it so much. And we have a wonderful co-parenting relationship. People, you know, rebuild their marriages, as you know, and have have a new marriage that comes out of this. And so this compassion, that this gift of compassion that I've been given from yoga, where everyone has their path and their lessons, and to see others as we see ourselves, to focus on this oneness instead of judgment and separateness, has really helped me in terms of just making me a better person.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. It's obviously worked, so well done. I guess to kind of wrap things up then, you know, pretty much your experience as far as at least with the betrayal that you experienced from your husband's unfaithfulness is very similar to what most, I think, betrayed spouses feel. And so to kind of end things, could you just kind of maybe share some words of advice or inspiration or words of hope even that you can share, you know, to make the listener's journey towards healing a little bit more, you know, be aware of what might be out there. Yeah, I can't talk. You know.
Sure. And I think you're referring to the part in the book where we get into a big fight and I'm in his closet and throwing his clothes around and not only behaving this way, but also feeling such rage and anger inside myself that I had never experienced before. And it was a scary feeling. It was like I felt really out of control in my emotions. And so, you know, my advice for someone going through this is that it's important to let yourself be angry or inappropriate or crying and yelling or whatever, you know, whatever your body is craving in that moment. You know, you need to give yourself the space, you know, to do that, obviously in a safe way, but, you know, it's important to feel what you feel, even if that's not pretty. And this is how we start to heal. This is how we process our emotions. This is how the energy, you know, moves through the body, and emotions definitely move. So, you know, they might not go from like crazy intense to disappear, but over time you'll notice that the emotions are shifting and changing and moving. I experienced a roller coaster in the beginning of like highs and lows and sometimes excitement and then sometimes like depths of despair. It was very difficult work to be in that place of feeling all those things that were so extreme for me. And, you know, I didn't like feeling that way. I didn't like crying. I didn't like, yelling. I didn't like being angry at all. I had a real big resistance to that. And that's another thing, like we're human beings, we're meant to experience a full range of emotions. And we tend to label certain emotions as good and certain emotions as bad. And the reality is that every emotion is neutral. Every emotion is valid, and every emotion wants to be felt and experienced. And and so that can be a really helpful idea for someone who is experiencing such a quick changing range of emotions in these, in, you know, as far as betrayal. And gosh, my words of hope and inspiration, you know, I know because of my personal experience that this is grueling work. And I know that this is painful, but I can promise everyone that if you make this your inward journey, you keep looking inside, and you make this your path to healing, you're going to arrive at a beautiful place on the other side. And, you know, my betrayal healed so many parts of myself. It was like a gift. And I can only say that looking back, you know, many years later, and I understand that. But that betrayal, you know, put me on a path of healing, a path of looking inside. And as a result of that, a lot of other things got healed. A lot of other things got addressed.
Right.
And so, you know, when you start on a path of healing, whatever it is that's the catalyst, it's a beautiful, wonderful journey, even though parts of it are really difficult and really uncomfortable. And everyone is strong enough. Everyone is resilient. Human beings we have an innate resilience that is inside each one of us. And you can walk through this fire and you can get to the other side. And on the other side of fire is a transformation. It's something new.
Great stuff, Molly. That's really good. Appreciate you saying that. I also appreciate you spending some time with me today, and congratulations again on your new book that just came out. Jeez, it's only been like about a week or two ago, isn't it?
It's only been a week, yes.
A week, yeah. So again, the title of the book is Fallen Star, A Return to Self Through the Eight Limbs of Yoga, and that's by Molly Chanson. And why don't you let our listeners know, you know, how they can reach you, your website address, you know, where to get the book, all that good stuff.
Sure. So, and thank you, Doug, so much.
I love
this conversation and the opportunity to share my experience, hopefully to help others. My website is mollychanson.com. And you can buy the book there. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and IndieBound and Kindle and a bunch of other places. So the links are on my website. And I have yoga classes galore. So I have a membership. I do private yoga if you want more one-on-one attention for your needs. And I have a new course, self-guided course called A Return to Self After Infidelity. And it has a lot of the lessons that we've talked about today for you to apply to your own situation. So,
okay, nice. So the yoga classes that you do, are these virtual or is it something that you do in person? And
the yoga classes are virtual. Yeah,
they are? Okay.
Everything.
Awesome.
So, you know, another maybe a blessing from being in COVID was that I started doing all my yoga online. And so the classes, I want to emphasize, are for everyone. It doesn't matter if you've never done yoga before or if you have a lot of experience. These classes are focused on healing and sort of the mind-body connection. And the membership is all online. We do meet live once a week. Everything's recorded, so people love it because there's 20-minute classes, 30-minute classes. You can do them anytime. And the private yoga also is virtual. So we meet and do our practice. Also can talk about anything that's going on. And, you know, sometimes 5 or 10 private yoga classes are really helpful, especially if you're going through a difficult time and kind of feeling out of control. And those are all recorded also, so you get your own little studio with your recordings and you can do the classes anytime you want. And so it's a great option when you're home and just want something accessible.
Yeah, it's like yoga therapy then, huh?
Yes.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, like you said, I guess it's one of the positive offshoots of this whole COVID mess is we never have to leave our houses anymore. So
right.
Get everything online, right? So
yeah.
Well, Molly, I so appreciate you taking some time today, and again, it's I really enjoyed reading your book, and appreciate you your work that you do, and you know, hopefully we'll be able to chat again sometime.
Yes. Thank you, Doug, so much for reading and asking such great questions.
You're very welcome. So, all right, Molly, take care.
Okay, you too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.